I'm Randy, the pastor half of the podcast, and my friend Kyle's a philosopher. This podcast hosts conversations at the intersection of philosophy, theology, and spirituality.
We also invite experts to join us, making public a space that we've often enjoyed off-air, around the proverbial table with a good drink in the back corner of a dark pub.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk Into a Bar.
Well, we are back for part two with Peter Rollins. So if you heard part one, you know somewhat of what you're in for here. It's going to be a lot like that was. We try to unpack some of his more complicated ideas, try to get to the bottom of some of them. At the end of it, I can say I feel a little bit better about understanding where he's coming from. But there are still fundamental disagreements and fundamental probably misunderstandings, as you will see. Mm-hmm. I'm very curious how listeners will receive this. So send us your questions, send us your reactions, your thoughts. I really want to know how this strikes you. If you feel at any point like, why can't they just say that more clearly? Just know that we also felt that. and we, honest to God, were trying. And I have this sense after this conversation that there are some things that maybe just can't be said super clearly. And it's interesting to me that if Peter is right, maybe the most important things about God are in that category. I don't know. That's compelling whether it bothers you or whether you like it. It's compelling either way.
Yeah, I think I had some real questions for Pete about what his concept of lack and negation and all that has to do with Jesus and what the scriptures and the New Testament understanding and even Christian orthodoxy, and you were getting at the same. But I think I just appreciate his commitment to this idea of lack at the center of mm-hmm. everything, of negation at the center of everything, and what that might mean and kind of potential ways out of messes that we find ourselves in as a society, as a culture, as in our cultural moment, mm-hmm. that perhaps uniting around this lack, uniting around differences, uniting around unknowability can actually bring us together, perhaps. I'm processing. We just literally got off the Zoom with Peter, so I'm still going to be processing for a long time this conversation, and I think it'll lead to another conversation. He's wonderful and very approachable and is like, yes, totally. This is a fun conversation. Let's dive back in. If nothing else, friends, if this is confusing for you, if it's a little bit frustrating, it's okay. Mm-hmm. Sit in that and ask some questions. Send in your questions to us. Even I would suggest that you jump onto prollins.com, I believe it is. Follow him on Patreon. He has tons of conversations and videos and talks and lectures that he has available and that he's constantly updating. And dive into the material if you're intrigued or if you're confused, and then come back to us and ask some more questions.
Help us understand it.
Yeah.
And if you don't like this, if this isn't for you, next episode will be totally different. No worries.
Yeah, but I do appreciate him saying, like, I am part of the Christian tradition. I consider myself a part of this faith expression, which actually puts me at odds against other ways of thinking and religious orders and all that. I appreciate when he can, when anyone can, but when a person like Pete Rollins, who thinks the way he does, can say, no, I consider myself within this tradition, even if some who are Christians would be like, that's not mine.
And not just within it, he's staking a claim about what the tradition means at bottom, right? Which is part of what I had some issues with, and that comes out a little bit in the conversation. And like, but one of the things I'm struggling with is like, is what he brings really just good for Lent, or is it good in general? Right? Because I knew him primarily through his Atheism for Lent stuff that we talked about last time, and I really liked it. But that's because it has a kind of functional place within a certain season of the Christian calendar that makes sense to me. And then you come out of it at Easter, right? But for him, you don't come out of it. It's the whole thing. And so that's what I'm struggling to make sense is that like...
Well, it reminds me of Keith DeRose a little bit, that if you are new to the show, you should go back and check out mm-hmm. our conversation with Keith DeRose. He's a philosopher at Yale. But Keith saying, I identify much more with Good Friday than I do with Easter. That seems much more compatible with reality and my lived experience. That's kind of where I feel Pete coming from a little bit, mm-hmm. but also that then he says that's where resurrection happens. That for me, I still need a little bit more information or thoughts from Pete to clarify how resurrection comes out of that.
Or how resurrection is even meaningful if God is at bottom nothingness.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, embrace, anyway.
embrace the conversation. Have fun diving in deep with us. If you can't understand the terminology that Kyle and Pete are throwing around, mm-hmm. you're in good company. Don't worry about
it. Google is your friend. Philosophical Dictionary is your friend. Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. You might want to visit.
There's going to be a lot of pausing in this show. Pauses and searches after this conversation. But I want to just say, because Pete is going to be posting this around his world and everything, I'm just grateful for his kindness and his kind of availability to engage in these kind of conversations with people like us.
Totally. So we're joined again by our friend Tim from the Power Bourbon YouTube channel, has sent us a bunch of delicious bourbon, and we're tasting another of them here, and it's blind. We have no idea what it is, but it smells awesome.
It smells like Cheerios to me.
Ooh.
It smells like cereal.
Nice.
Interesting. I could get on board with like Cocoa Puffs because I'm getting some chocolate in there.
Yeah, sure. Yep. Just straight up cereal though. With a little heat in there.
It smells like it's gonna taste dusty.
So for your viewers that are big into bourbon, I get Flintstone vitamins, which
nice.
That is so specific.
Some people something.
Yes, totally. If you're old enough to know the reference, that's there.
That takes me back.
Man, Cheerios and Flintstone vitamins, yeah.
I'm going to guess another lower proof one. We've had a couple of those before.
It tastes like Flintstone vitamins.
You can't not think about that now.
Yeah, no, that ruined me.
Yeah, I can get a chalky thing out of it if I try. That makes it sound bad, though, and it does not taste bad.
No. It's a bit stanky, though. It's got a bit of funk.
Especially the aftertaste.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you told me this was another of those dusty things, I'd believe you.
Yep. It's even got a little bit of medicinal cherry notes, kind of like a Robitussin in there, too.
Yep, yep, mm-hmm. yep, yep.
Everything we're naming is unpleasant on its own,
I
promise
Robitussin.
It tastes good.
Oh, man. I used to just have epic battles with my parents trying to get out of taking a Robitussin.
Yeah, man, it's awful.
This is good. This is good. It's very unique. Tell us what it is, Tim.
So this is Barrel Craft Spirits Bourbon, their 15-year-old gray label.
What?
Oh. What?
See, this is Kyle thinking he should have liked it more.
That is exactly what it is. That's crazy, man.
Wow.
Yeah, so the Flintstone vitamin notes you get is what we refer to as Dickel notes from the Dickel Distillery. So it's mainly Tennessee distillate.
So does most Dickel stuff have that character?
Yeah, so you've got a big part of the community that really likes Tennessee whiskey, or they don't, and it's all if they like Flintstone vitamins, or if they don't.
Wow.
So that Dickel flavor would be one of the key markers of a Tennessee whiskey versus a Kentucky?
Yes.
Wow. Interesting.
So Dickel is one of those that has really ultra-aged stock that other people can buy that... like Barton has out of Kentucky and a couple places like that. Jack doesn't have the ultra age stuff. So generally, if you see source from Tennessee, it's from Dickel.
Any idea what would cause it to have that flavor profile that's ubiquitous across Tennessee whiskeys?
I do believe it's the filtration process through the charcoal
filters. Yeah.
I thought that was just Jack Daniel's. Is that everybody?
To be Tennessee whiskey, you got to be charcoal filtered.
No way. Okay. Wow. All right. Something.
So say what this is again, Tim.
This is Barrel Craft Spirits Bourbon, the 15-year-old gray label.
Wow. All right. Cheers. Cheers to Tim, and please go watch The Power of Bourbon on YouTube. Peter Rollins, thank you for joining us again on A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk into a Bar. Welcome back.
Oh, it's great to be back for part two. I'm excited. This may even start to be the beginning of part three.
Hey, who knows? Because who knows?
I've seen some of your questions, and they're so deep that it might take us all day just to answer a couple of them.
Yep.
Yeah, especially with what you bring. So last time we spoke, Pete, we talked a lot about the lack, the kind of the void and the abyss, and maybe God is in the abyss, God is in the void, God, you know, we need to not run from the lack, but actually embrace it and embrace the asymmetry. What I've been thinking about since we spoke is, I really enjoy that perspective, but how do you reconcile that, or how do you explain it, or do you even care to reconcile and explain it in light of what we find in the New Testament? In particular, the Apostle Paul saying things like, in Christ, all the fullness of the Godhead dwells in bodily form, or the church's job is to attain maturity and wholeness to the full measure of the fullness of Christ that we find. There's a lot of fullness that we find in the New Yes. Testament describing Christ, describing what we find in Jesus. Jesus is the fulfillment of the law and prophets. I could go on, and you know the texts. How do you reconcile Yep. those two things, or how do you hold those two things?
Yeah, so I mean, to start with, what I don't want to do is try to pretend that the biblical text is some sort of, you know, univocal voice or something like that. So I'm going to say something that might make it sound like I am saying that. So that's why I'm starting off with a disclaimer that I'm not saying that. However, what I would say is that I take certain parts of the biblical text as a type of hermeneutical key to reading the rest. Now, what I don't mean by that is that I want to put everything else into a Procrustean bread where I stretch it and cut it to fit. But there is, and I'll mention three of the main things, would be, you know, creation story, the crucifixion, the resurrection, as kind of like this hermeneutical key. And in, for example, the crucifixion, which I'm sure we'll be talking about a lot more in this conversation, you have, you know, this notion of the death of God, right, which I take very seriously. And also, in addition to the death of God, you have the self-alienation of God in at least a couple of the Gospels. So you have these kind of very fundamental ideas. So what I would do if I was so inclined, I might want to say this, is that take fascism as an example. Fascism is a ideology of wholeness and completeness, right? So the fascist believes in an organic system where everything runs and in a kind of like in an organic kind of whole. And then, of course, the figure of the Jew is the obstacle that prevents the smooth running of the system. So if you read Mein Kampf, Hitler is always talking about this kind of the body is this smooth running organism, and then the Jew is a virus, et cetera, et cetera. So in fascism, there is this desire for wholeness, completeness. But you could make an argument that fascism is not full and whole enough because it doesn't make space for the exception. And actually, I mean, if you think of Hegel, and Hegel says, he talks about what's called the identity of identity and difference, that to have wholeness means you also have to include that which is outside of the whole. So in other words, what we talked about with Gödel's incompleteness theorem, which we might come back to, but is that what if reality is fully computable, but also has a truth that is not computable, then the whole requires both everything that is computable and that which is not. In other words, fullness requires also embracing the lack. So I would maybe play around philosophically with that, but I don't know if it would fit with that, because that's not what I think the original authors were thinking at the time, you know. But I am wanting to say that all of reality includes a dimension that is not computable. And the two ideologies that reject that are superstition and scientism. So scientism says basically all there is computable reality, and superstition says there's that even the other, the kind of the spiritual, is able to be manipulated, known, named, understood. So you've got scientism and superstition as two ways of trying to render the world whole, but I think therefore excluding a central dimension of reality, which is a truth that is not computable. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's how I would understand wholeness and fullness, is you have to include that. And I take that from the Bible. I mean, that for me is Christianity. For me, Christianity is the idea that that reality is is not, so there's, I'll say this very quickly, sorry, there's kind of broadly three metaphysical positions about ultimate reality, right? Reality is one, monism. Reality is two, right? The universe is a dual organized system, or reality is multiple, right? It's a pile of monads. Everything is individual. Everything is different. For me, Christianity is the idea that reality is not one. So reality is not one, it's not two, it's not multiple. Reality is a dialectic. It is a one that is not at one with itself. And so we can count that as three, which is the one, which is two, because it's divided, and the divide itself, Father, Son, and Holy
Okay,
Ghost.
There it is.
Yeah. So for, you know, that would be how I would describe fullness from a Christological perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
That's Pat. Where we left off at the very end last time with that seemingly like plot twist towards Trinitarianism.
Oh, yes, so I know. I like your surprise at the very end going, I want us to go into that a bit more.
So I'm glad you just counted it for us. So we have the one, the, you know, the Platonian whatever whole
oneness,
oneness, and then we have, but that can't actually be one. There's got to be some division in it because of all that stuff you just described. Any whole also includes exceptions, and so if we want to include that as part of the whole, then that's two. And then there's a relation between the whole and its exceptions. Is that fair? And so that would be the third. Couldn't we keep like arbitrarily adding to that? Couldn't we just find ways to insert a fourth and a fifth and get some kind of multiplicity beyond three?
Well, that's why I was about to kind of hesitate about the third being the relation between the two, because for me the third is simply the not at one. So the way I would describe it is there's a city in Northern Ireland that is called, it's got two names. It's called Derry or Londonderry, depending on whether you're Catholic or Protestant. During the Troubles in Northern Ireland, this was a way actually for people to tell whether you were, you know, a nationalist or a unionist, as they would ask you to name the city. And it was always very dangerous because if you said Londonderry to Catholics, you might get in trouble and vice versa. But anyway, the city was called Londonderry or Derry. And in the media, the news presenters would always say Derry stroke Londonderry, right, to try to avoid the problem. So Derry stroke Londonderry. And then there was a radio host in Belfast who just took out the Derry and Londonderry and just called it Stroke City. So instead of Londonderry or Derry stroke Londonderry, just called it Stroke City, right? Yeah. And so it was named by the stroke itself. Now, there is one city named in two different ways, and there is the antagonism itself. And for me, that's what the Freudian unconscious is. The unconscious is not a Jungian unconscious. It's not a something. It is that which disturbs the oneness of consciousness. And that's what I mean by Holy Ghost and Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, is that you just have the one and the disturbance within the one. And that's why I don't think you can kind of like go an infinite journey with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm trying to follow what that means. You have the one and the disturbance of the one. Can you explain that in a Trinitarian way for simpletons like me, Pete?
In other words, Claude Lévi-Strauss had a brilliant way of describing this. I forget the essay. It's in Structural Anthropology. And there was this village, and the village, it was organized in a certain way. And there was this anthropologist interviewed the people in the village. And half the people in the village described the mapping of the village that on the inside was the temple and where the people, a certain group were housed around the temple. And then on the outside was kind of the proletariat, right? Then the other people in the village, they described the village as being cut in half with one group on one side and one group on the other. And what was interesting was, these two descriptions of the cartography or whatever of the village were completely different, right? Now, what some anthropologists then did is they said, well, there must be a real cartography, like maybe taking a picture from the air, and then you can see how it's really, really created. But actually, what you really have is you have two different descriptions of the reality that don't map in a dual organization. It's not yin and yang. They don't match. They're completely discordant. And I could do this with Republicans and Democrats in America, whatever. So a discordant, different way of mapping social reality. And the fantasy is that there is a real way of mapping social reality outside the antagonism of these two positions. The Lacanian real is the name for the antagonism itself. The antagonism that's generated from the two different interpretations of reality creates, you could say, an illusion of a third, but there is no third. There is just the antagonism itself. And the antagonism, as I say, is what a psychoanalyst would call the real. It's not real. It's the reality of the non-at-oneness of the village with itself.
And how does that relate to the Trinity then, Pete, or to a Trinitarian way of thinking?
So for me, the Trinity comes out of the biblical text, right? It's not in the biblical text, but I actually think it's true to the biblical text.
Okay.
And the Trinity, I would say, is a theological attempt to describe the truth of this divided nature of the absolute. Then it becomes philosophical with Hegel. And then I would say with the Enlightenment, you see the Trinitarian notion entering into science as well and various scientific endeavors. So for me, the Trinity is the truth. And this comes to the very heart of why I call myself a Christian is, for me, Christianity is a description. It gives a truth concerning the nature of reality and also a way for us to correctly orient ourselves to that truth. And that truth is expressed, I think, in this notion that reality is not at one with itself. And that when you embrace that non-at-oneness within yourself, you identify with Christ, who experiences the non-at-oneness, and you're actually unified in the disunity.
Mm-hmm. Okay. One more question about in this direction, mm-hmm. and I'll let Kyle have some fun. So I would identify as a progressive Christian, and that isn't so much having to do with the fact that, like, I affirm homosexuality or I'm, you know, this, that, or the other theologically. I just mean, I think that reality in the universe is moving towards wholeness and completeness and fullness because of the resurrection of Christ, because of new creation that, you know, we're moving towards. How do we embrace the lack and embrace the nothingness, embrace the abyss and meet God there while also moving towards and anticipating a united and whole future? Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And I'm here to try to convert you. I'm going to try to save your soul. I don't know if we're going to be able to do it in this one episode, but let me try, okay? To save
you from progressivism. I'm ready. Come, Lord Jesus.
Okay, ready. Okay. Are you ready? Is your heart open?
Yes.
I want you to be accepted.
Let's go.
So I'll give you a few kind of reasons why I'm concerned about progressivism, and then we'll kind of draw it out from there. You know, one, I'm an apocalypticist, right? So a progressive is someone who sees, as you say, the universe progressing, almost like Teilhard de Chardin to an omega point, a progression of history. Yep. One of the issues for me with progressivism is you kind of know where it's going, right? Mm-hmm. So obviously, talk progressives is the kind of, you know where it's going.
Or believe,
and,
yeah.
And it's about fighting for that movement forward, the progress. Now, as an apocalypticist doesn't know the future. An apocalypticist is someone who all they can do is raise up the antagonisms of the present age, mm-hmm. bring them to the surface, and something new will erupt. Now, to use an example, I want to use Northern Ireland as an example. In 1998, the peace process came into action called the Good Friday Agreement.
Yep.
And it was an apocalyptic moment because what happened is all of the political leaders and all the major paramilitary parties, they had to give up their idea of what the future of Northern Ireland looked like. And they had to sit down in a room together and talk together and debate together until something erupted that no one would see. Mm-hmm. Now, both Kierkegaard and Hegel embraced this idea Kierkegaard said, life is lived forwards but understood backwards.
Yes.
So you never understand the future, you only understand the past. And Hegel said, the Isle of Minerva spreads her wings at dusk, which means that philosophy understands the past, but it doesn't understand the future. And I'll give one example of this in terms of just practical in therapy. A good psychoanalysis, if a couple are arguing and they go to analysis to figure out whether to stay together or break up, the analyst doesn't really know the answer either. The issue is everything comes up. All the antagonisms that have been kept beneath the surface are bubbled up. And the only thing that everybody knows, the analyst knows, is things can't stay the same. They might break up. They might stay together. They might break up with the type of relationship they had, whatever. But all you can do is bring the antagonisms up to the surface, and then a new rupture will happen. This is Hegel's kind of position in the phenomenology of spirit, but it's also Karl Marx's position. Karl Marx's position, with a couple of exceptions, was a critique of capitalism, not telling you what the next thing looks like. So there's about five pages on communism in the whole of Marx's work. His thing was a critique of capitalism, the idea that every time, just like science fiction is not about the future, it's an idealization of the present, right? So whenever you see science fiction, you're really finding out about the present. Marx and Hegel and Kierkegaard all agree on this, that our fantasies of the future are idealized dimensions of our present reality. And so the job of the activist is to, as an apocalypticist, not knowing, you know, basically what happens after the apocalypse, the job is to show the central antagonisms of the present age and let something else erupt, not even knowing if it's going to be better or worse. So that's one reason. But also, progressives generally take a non-Christological look at the biblical text. So, like, Jesus died because he stood up against injustice, and you know, we should read the red letters of Christ, and we should try and be good to our neighbor, etc., etc. So they generally, whereas conservatives really take seriously, in a sense, the idea of Christology and whatever. Another reason why I'm not progressive as such is because I take a very deep Christological understanding of Christianity. I think it is an insight into the nature of reality, and not just a moral guide, but rather an invitation to a different mode of being through this self-division. And then, of course, I reject the notion of a wholeness and a completeness. For me, rather, Christianity is a freedom from wholeness and completeness, and an ability to embrace darkness, despair, unknowing, and ultimately the absurd. I'll say one final thing, sorry, is that Tertullian, now it's a paraphrase, he didn't quite say this, but you famously said, "I believe in the crucifixion of Christ because it is absurd," right? Mm-hmm. And the one thing everyone agrees with is that that's ridiculous, right? So theists don't like it because Christianity is true, therefore it's not absurd. And atheists don't like it because Christianity is absurd and therefore not true. Right. So what does it mean to say Christianity is true because it's absurd? Mm-hmm. That's what I affirm. Mm-hmm. That Christianity is a fundamental embrace of the absurd. And again, this is where I rely on a certain heretical reading of Kierkegaard, that faith is the embrace of a radical lack and unknowing and contradiction at the heart of everything. So yes, that's what I would argue. And okay, we can unpack that as much as you want.
Oh boy.
We could just talk for the next hour about that.
Okay. What is the virtue of that way of viewing it, that Christianity is at bottom about embracing the absurd or the lack or the contradiction or whatever, over the conviction of the progressivist as you've described it, which I don't understand my own progressivism in that way? Progressivism is not futurism. It's not. And I think there's a version of apocalypticism and a version of progressivism that can marry happily.
Yes.
I think that's just because you like Kierkegaard, or you don't want to give him up, but you also want to be a progressive. I think eventually.
Well, I also think you might be leaning too hard on the pseudonyms and not hard enough on Kierkegaard's actual very Lutheran thought. But
I'm very Lutheran. Anyway, sorry, but keep going.
But what is the virtue of the one? Because they're both making a claim, right?
Yeah.
The progressive, as you've defined it, is looking forward to some kind of ethical future where everything is virtuous and all the problems are eliminated. Why you couldn't also have a Christological element to that, I'm not quite clear, but they're at least looking forward to something that we can define now. Mm. And then on your version, we're not looking forward to anything. We're embracing the lack. But there is still a position implied there, which is that the lack is primary, or it's somehow metaphysically prior, or it's at, you know,
foundational.
It's the found, right. They both have a foundation. One is ethical and forward looking, but one is equally, it's still making a claim. So if like I were just the agnostic, just pressing for intellectual humility here, I couldn't choose between them, right? I would have to say they're both making a claim and the evidential basis for choosing is unclear. So what is it for you that privileges the one over the other?
Yeah, so like I would argue that, I don't know if we talked about this in the last episode, but it'll be good to cover it again if we did. But C.S. Lewis has a famous argument for the existence of God. Did we cover this? That it's the argument from desire. It's actually a scholastic argument.
Right.
Just for your listeners, it's the idea that I think Augustine had a version of this. There's a few versions of it, but say C.S. Lewis was to give a very clear version that human beings have certain desires, and those desires can be fulfilled. Desire for food, for water, for sexual intimacy, for shelter, whatever. And in addition to that, we find ourselves having a desire for the eternal, a desire for this dimension beyond the world. And, you know, just in a nutshell, the argument is that because all of our desires seem to have an object that can fulfill them, it's reasonable for us to think that this desire that we have for something eternal can also be fulfilled, right? Mm-hmm. But the issue for me in that is it fundamentally misses the key Freudian insight, which is human beings, not only do we have desires that can be fulfilled, and in psychoanalysis, they're called demands, not desire, right? We also have a desire for desire itself, and that's called drive. So the desire for desire itself is ontological, right? It's not contingent. It means that if you got rid of the desire for desire, you wouldn't get heaven, right? So you no longer desire, you retire, you get everything you want, you get everything you could possibly imagine, right? Would actually be the death of subjectivity, because the desire for desire itself is basically a desire for lack, for a type of struggle, for a type of unknowing, for a type of mystery, et cetera, et cetera. Now, if this is true, this is just, there could make a million arguments, but just using this argument, if it is true that ontologically speaking, we have a desire for desire itself, again, this is called drive in psychoanalysis, we have a desire for desire itself, then fantasizing a world, a complete world, which, I mean, I hate to say it, but it's very New Age and very fascist, which I think New Age and fascism are very intertwined. You scratch a hippie, ooh, you get
shots
a fascist.
Fired.
I lived in LA for a long time. And the reason is they both, you know, but also in capitalism, there's a fantasy of the sacrifice of sacrifice. There's the fantasy of getting to a point in which sacrifice itself is sacrificed and we can sit by the beach and just drink our margaritas and have pure happiness. And what I would argue is that is hell, that to abolish desire, the desire for desire, in other words, the desire for lack, is fundamentally the a death of subjectivity. So for me, I don't want to drive the point home too much, but it's that the idea that there is some fundamental sacrifice and unknowing and complexity is not just, I think, philosophically sound. I think it's also true to the ontology of subjectivity, but I also think it's true of reality itself.
This is really good. I feel like it would take us 100 conversations to even unpack one of these things.
Yes.
Someday I want to talk to you about one thing, and we're just going to get to the bottom of that one thing.
Yes.
And we're going to set up boundaries and not be able to deviate from one topic.
I don't think we can
get to
the bottom.
That's not going to be this conversation, unfortunately. Okay, so for me, all of my questions mostly come back to what does it mean to say that there's negativity or a lack at the bottom of everything?
Can I use an example then of
sure,
terms of contemporary society?
Mm-hmm.
Very quickly, like, you know, what does this look like? So I make a very important distinction between community and communion. And a community basically is a group who share positive characteristics, beliefs, values, a shared enemy, whatever, it's positive characteristics. Now, in contemporary society, you have two broad positions. You have liberals who associate with the right, and you have liberals who associate with the left. for argument's sake. So those on the right advocate for positive universals, truth, justice, merit, facts. So on the right, you have people saying things like we live in a meritocracy, or we should do, right? You know, and institutions should be blind and largely hopefully are blind. And you have things like facts don't care about your feelings, all of that. So the watchword of the right is equality. And equality means we all, these values of truth and justice are universal, positive characteristics enshrined in institutions that are equally applied to everybody. Then you have the critique of that, which is identity politics, right? So, and the critique of that is the idea that this is actually crypto-identitarianism, that all of these seeming positive universals are actually particular positions that are disguised as a universal. They really privilege some people over others. They benefit some groups over others. So we say the judicial system is blind, but it's not really. We say that, oh, anybody can be employed in this work environment, but it really only certain people get employed and certain people don't. Right. So the watchword there is equity. Equity meaning there is no universal that is blind to everybody. So you have to give different groups different things depending on what they need. You don't have with, say, the right, it's equality, it's positive universals, and it's one community under these positive universals. With the liberal left, it's particularism. You've got multiple communities intersecting with each other and with equity being the value, right? My argument is that the critique of critique, right, is where you say, okay, there is a universal, but the universal is not a positive. The universal is a negativity. What we all share in common by dint of language and desire is that we are all castrated. There is a type of lack or nothingness that marks all subjects. Now, in a very basic level, you see this in desire. We're all desiring subjects, which means we all experience lack and we all speak. You know, if we could say everything we want to say, we wouldn't say anything, right? So we are always speaking because in a sense, we can never quite say what we want to say. So, and that's communion. So what I'm arguing is Christianity builds a communion, which is a group of people gathered together around a shared loss, a shared lack that they hold in common. And it's a communion because in the Eucharist, it's a meal around the death of God, which is the lack at the heart of everything. So the communion is a liturgy in which people get together, not because of shared enemies, shared beliefs, shared values, but because of shared negativity. So that's very practically, that would be how I would situate it within the contemporary world.
Okay. I think that was helpful.
Well, I think progressives are the second, by the way. So I would say, I think progressives are generally particularists.
Right.
Anyway.
Yeah, sure. I was once at a conference dinner with Alvin Plantinga, and he's a famous analytic philosopher.
Oh, I've read a lot of him.
And he told this joke. He said, "What do you get when you cross a continental philosopher with the mafia?" And the punchline was, "An offer you can't understand."
I've used that joke myself. I love that joke.
And I always thought it was rich coming from the guy that wrote The Nature of Necessity, right? Which is a famously hard book to get through. But one of the virtues of that kind of writing is that there is a path that any sufficiently intelligent person could in principle follow to understand the theses in that book. Mm-hmm. What is the path that I could follow to understand a sentence like God is nothingness? Because as hard as I try, it just seems contradictory to me. And I want to distinguish here between a contradiction and a paradox. So there's a version of this claim that I'm very happy with. Not happy, but I think it's an important part of reality and of Christianity in particular. It's the thing that Kierkegaard harped on over and over and over again, and that is the paradoxical nature of the claim that the infinite became finite, that God took on human form and then died. And I think that that goes to the point where I'm actually happy and have made the case in print with the idea that you can be both a Christian and an atheist. That makes sense to me. But it's a different claim to say that Christianity is atheism, or that at bottom, somehow almost all the Christians in history have misunderstood what they've been doing, and that the thing that they've been worshiping was actually nothingness, are actually a negation. And somehow all of the great theologians and philosophers in Christian history have missed that fact, with like a handful of exceptions. So help me to understand how what you're doing is not just a kind of hubristic dismissal of that entire history. And when you say you're a Christian worshiping God and that thing is actually nothingness, help that make sense to me.
I don't want to dismiss anybody. I mean, and if you, watch my work or engage with it, you'll notice that I never disparage anybody. My God. And in fact, I just did a talk 2 days ago where I talked about, I was critiquing people who critiqued evangelical Christianity and for a variety of reasons, and I was holding my colleagues to account and myself to account on that, that we always have to be deeply sensitive to taking seriously our interlocutors, and also understanding that one's religion and one's work, one's vocation, can be doing a multiple jobs at the same time. This is very important to me. Something that I think analytic philosophy kind of misses to some extent is, somebody can rationally believe something like Christianity, but also it provides a function, sometimes propping up the paternal function if there was an issue in childhood or whatever. Anyway, side point, I don't want to disparage anybody. I think whatever position you take in the world, mind you, you're going to find yourself at odds with millions of people, right? whatever it is. So I don't know. You're knocking on an open door there. I think that, whatever one believes, as I say, throw a stone and you'll hit someone who disagrees with you. I am a Christian. I see myself very much embedded in the Christian tradition, which puts me at odds with Buddhism and various forms of atheism and millions of other people. So is your question primarily, how do I see myself in relation to Christianity in particular?
Yeah. I would like to hear the answer to that. I would also just like to understand the claim that God, which has, as I understand it, from almost the entirety of Christian history, a pretty well-defined nature, and is like a thing and not a not thing. How the sentence, God is nothingness, can be meaningful. And I don't mean how it can be useful in my life, how it can have a function like atheism for Lent or something like that, but how it's coherent, how it has any truth value, how it is different from the sentence, four is purple.
Yes. Okay, so I can do it a couple of ways. One is I could try to take the traditional definition of God and see if it can apply to what I'm saying. That's one thing, which I think it can, but I'll start with really basically first, because you're asking also like how to make sense of this idea that contradiction lies at the heart of everything. Yes. So for me, it's actually super simple. Much simpler than, and the reason why I started in analytic philosophy, interestingly, and I went away from it, that this position is fundamentally simple in that anyone who does psychoanalysis proper, whether they understand these notions theoretically, will undergo the experience. And what I mean by that is, a symptom, the definition of a symptom is a coagulation of a contradiction that solves a problem and gives a substitute enjoyment. So, for example, somebody clenches their teeth, and maybe through analysis, they find out that they want to shout at their partner, but they're scared that if they shout at their partner, their partner will leave them. And so how this is manifesting is in clenching their teeth so they don't shout, or biting your nails, which is a kind of sense of which maybe you want to attack your boss, but you don't want to get fired. So you're literally biting your claws, right? Biting your nails. But, we all have these symptoms, and symptoms are fascinating things. So you go to analysis and, you with some symptom that's causing you problems. And as you unpack it, you make connections with other contradictions within you, right? So maybe you actually didn't want to shout at your siblings or your parents because you were scared that they would shout at you. So you connect this current thing with your partner and with your boss, with your childhood, right? And you start to make all of these interesting, weird connections between things that are happening in your life and the past. Now, in therapy, often the idea is to overcome contradiction ultimately. So mental health generally means there's a pre-traumatic subject and there's a post-traumatic subject. And the idea is to adapt you better to your world, to get you to a point where, you know, you're better able to be productive in the world or whatever. So analysis isn't therapy as such. In psychoanalysis, you keep going down deeper and deeper into deeper and deeper contradictions. And the cure is when, for a neurotic, the cure is when you realize that you are a contradiction, that you're full of contradictory desires, that you hate the person that you love, that you want to talk and not talk, that you're between life and death, that you're full of these contradictions. Now, that psychoanalytically is kind of like, is, as I say, the cure. The cure is that you, instead of always chasing something that would work, you realize nothing works, but also that the not working is itself enjoyable, the source of enjoyment. Now, very quickly, what Hegel does in his Phenomenology of Spirit, complex as it is, probably one of the most difficult books it's ever been written, but he basically shows that life is a series of attempts to overcome contradiction. So we can take the main ones, life out of being, consciousness out of life, self-consciousness out of consciousness, reason out of self-consciousness, right? Take those major events in cosmic history, right? Hegel shows that each of these is an attempt to overcome a contradiction. But what happens is actually the contradiction is not overcome, it's just deepened and deepened and deepened. And Hegel, and this is where I think Kierkegaard misunderstood Hegel, right? What Hegel called absolute knowledge was when you come to the realization that contradiction is what drives reality, but that contradiction ultimately, and Lacan called this a santom, there is a fundamental knot or contradiction at the heart of everything. And when you come to that fundamental insight, that's a philosophical insight, but in psychoanalysis, it's a therapeutic insight. And then in radical theology, it's a liturgical insight.
Mm-hmm. And it's still an insight that I'm struggling to make sense of. I just wonder if we're equivocating. Like, are we just using the same words fundamentally differently here? Because to me, contradiction means something such that a sentence like there's a contradiction at the heart of everything is literally nonsense. In the terms of classical logic,
in terms of like a square triangle, yes. Yeah. We're not talking about like a square triangle.
So like, are the psychoanalysts using the term to mean what, say, an analytic philosopher would call something like a tension or insert some kind of synonym that has some positive content? Because clearly it exists in the world, right? There are people, as you describe. Maybe we're all as you describe. I don't think the evidence supports that, but maybe we are. And in which case, that entails that there is a real thing that is what we're calling a contradiction, which is just not what most people mean by contradiction.
Well, and this is why I refer to, you know, Gödel's incompleteness theorem, is that as just one example, we could also take a very, like Hegel's an example, I think, and a version of Kierkegaard maybe, but in Gödel's incompleteness theorem, the contradiction is not a square triangle. It's not that kind of contradiction. Right. The contradiction is reality is a total system and an exception, that there is a non-totalizable. Mm-hmm. And so Roger Penrose, the cosmologist, and I'm not talking about Deepak Chopra here, I'm talking about one of the world's greatest cosmologists, you know, because last time we did talk about how, you know, when you're referring to physics and mathematics, it can go woo-woo. But when I talk about Gödel, he's one of the greatest mathematicians of the 20th century. And Roger Penrose is one of the greatest living cosmologists. And he, when he talks about proto-consciousness, and I think he should call it proto-unconsciousness, right? I think that's wrong. What he calls proto-consciousness is he says that reality generates in its total system something that is in the system but not of it, in the world but not of it. Now, actually, in psychoanalysis, mental health is about helping you integrate into the world. Psychoanalysis is designed to help you be in the world but not of it, to embrace a type of non-oneness with the world. And that's the contradiction I mean. And the reason why it's called contradiction in continental philosophy is because it cannot be harmonized. It is an inherent ontological contradiction. It's ontological, you know?
Yeah, so maybe that's the point, and I think I even wrote this down to revisit, is ontological versus epistemological. I think you called it unknowing in our previous episode, but there's other words you could use. Because like Gödel to me is in the epistemological category because it's about the provability of an axiomatic system. It's not obviously about metaphysics. You could make a case that it has metaphysical implications. I'm open to that case. But like what he was doing is showing that in a well-defined axiomatic system, there will be statements that are both true and unprovable. And that's fine.
But it's not epistemological because it's not that, but it's in principle knowable in the future. It's inherently unknowable. It's like in quantum mechanics where there
within the domain of proving an axiomatic system, which is not religion, which is not, you know, psychology, and it's not human meaning. It's within a very specific domain, and it's still an open position to affirm that and to then also affirm some kind of metaphysical, or maybe better, some kind of epistemological progressivism, as we've understood progressivism, which says that human knowledge is ever increasing. And even though there might be these kinds of axiomatic limitations on it, that doesn't mean we're going to like reach a point where we can't go any further, or that at bottom, knowledge has a limit.
First of all, absolutely right. I am obsessed with watching YouTube videos about stuff that I don't know, right? I am not making a claim that I can't know more and that, you know, human beings can't know more. Absolutely not. There's an infinite sea of things that you know, we don't know yet and we can know. But the claim is ontological. And this is where I think Gödel is making an ontological claim, is that...
Can you pause for a second, Pete? What do you mean when you say the claim is ontological? Can you explain that?
Oh yeah. So in epistemological unknowing, right? In kind of epistemological humility. Let's call it epistemological humility. That's the idea that there are things that I don't know, and there's things, and it could be personal humility, right? There's things that I, as Peter Rawlins, don't know, and it can also be, you know, globally, right? There's things that we don't know, but it's still knowable, right? It's in principle these things are knowable. And you kind of like, even if it's a regulative principle and we'll never get there, hypothetically, you're moving towards like what you mentioned earlier, an omega point, a point where if you had an infinite mind, like God could know everything, right? God, like, so if you were God, you could know everything, right? That's epistemological humility to say, I am not God. I don't have the mind of God. Mm-hmm. Ontological unknowing is where you say that there is an unknowing in the heart of reality itself, which means that the universe is non-deterministic at its core. There is a non-deterministic dimension. Interestingly, the arguments for the existence of God go into this, is that if you think about, the idea of a first cause, the Kalam argument, which is one of the weakest arguments for the existence of God, but the Kalam argument, you know, you go back in this chain. What was that?
You just made some of our listeners angry.
Oh, is that right? Oh, yeah. No, I mean, if you want a good cosmological argument, I mean, Aquinas, you know, Aristotle's argument is so much better. Anyway, it's such a stronger cosmological argument, I think. But the funny thing is, I think what the Kalam argument does is it gives us a real insight into the nature of language, right? So you have a chain, and you go like, at the beginning of the chain there is an uncaused cause, and then everything is determined from there, but the one thing that's not determined is the uncaused cause, right? That's the, so there is kind of one exception to the infinite web and the infinite chain. In linguistics it's similar. There's what's called a master signifier, which is language. The first word in language isn't the word, because language requires two words. Language is differential, right? So you can't have language with one word. You can't have up without down, right? So language begins with two words. So the first word doesn't have any meaning until the second word comes in. And then the second word retroactively interprets the first word. So now you're in the realm of language. How I would unpack that is to say that there is a dimension in, there's deterministic reality. Reality is deterministic. But there is bubbling within the deterministic universe a non-deterministic core. So ontological unknowing is saying basically that there is something that God doesn't know. If God, you know, because it's unknowable, it's only probabilistic. Ontological unknowing is the idea that there is an unknowing that is an inherent part of nature itself.
How do we get from that, which seems to me like a kind of pre-theoretical commitment? I don't want to call it an axiom, but it's like a...
you guys are going to have to start defining
however the evidence on the ground shakes out, I'm going to interpret it according to this commitment, which is that there's an unknowing. But the step to saying it's probabilistic seems to me an unjustified step, or maybe a step that needs some justification, right? Because probabilistic means a specific thing that is different from just saying it's unknowing at the bottom, or there's some kind of limitation on our ability to know or whatever.
So I would say it's the opposite. And I think you're saying we need to dumb it down a little bit. So I'll try and dumb it down a little bit. But, but first of all, I'll make one philosophical point. And then we'll, but, you know, Hegel's phenomenology of spirit is the exact opposite of this. Is he tries to show that you can start anywhere and you will get to this point. So he starts with consciousness of subject and object. So a basic experience that I'm a subject, I experience objects in the world. And then the phenomenology of spirit starts there and takes you on a journey throughout the history of the universe to the point where of absolute knowledge. That's kind of the Hegel's whatever. Now, I'll give a concrete example of what I mean by this in terms of Christianity. I would argue, and as we can debate it, that in Christianity, if you imagine Christianity is one of those choose your own adventure books, and you turn to page 20 and it says Johnny's in a prayer meeting and he's praying to God, and then he realizes, I think all of this is crap. Should Johnny leave the church, turn to page 20, or stay in the prayer, or like repress his doubts and keep going? What I would argue is that yes, the people who leave when Christianity seems rubbish, right? They just get an ersatz god, you know, whether it's to say sexual enlightenment, psychedelic enlightenment, commodity satisfaction. There's all these ersatz gods that do the same thing. What I argue is that Christianity is an escape room that you can only get out of by going all the way in. And what I mean by that is the people who follow my work, most of them come from the Christian thing, and they're not the people who didn't take it seriously. They're the people who destroyed their record collections. They're the before they were all on, you know, phones. They're the people who gave all their money to the church, became missionaries. And the idea is that you go all the way in, and then you experience from within Christianity an alienation. Mm-hmm. My God, why have you forsaken me? From within it. And when you experience that crucifixion moment, that moment where you experience this fundamental failure, that is the success of Christianity. That is the moment when you identify with Christ crucified, and that's where resurrection occurs. So for me, it's not that you start by presupposing that everything is contradictory. Nobody does that. It's the most philosophically and commonsensically crazy thing to think. No one starts there. I didn't start there, my goodness. You start by trying to overcome contradiction. You start by always trying to overcome. And this brings you into ever more complex places. And I would but argue until you actually encounter Christ crucified, until you identify with the one who lost their identity, and in that identity with the one who lost all identity, that's the salvatory event. And I'll say it in one other way very quickly, on a very practical level, is that one of the things we suffer from is, as human beings, is there's the God of prohibition from the past, right? This is in the past where there was this idea of, you know, life's a bit shit, and it's a bit shit for all of us, but you have to just get on with it, right? And that's the God of kind of prohibition, and it's feudalism. And there's some lord who has it all, but we don't have it all. That actually, for all of the terribleness of it, at least we're all in it together, right? We live today psychoanalytically in the God is the God of the demand to enjoy. So that's the theological world we live in, which is constantly we're surrounded by this idea that we're not castrated. Well, that everyone around us isn't castrated, that we can be all that we can be, that we can be happy, have loads of sex, have loads of friends. The superegoic injunction is no longer, oh, you should be nicer to your mom, but why aren't you out more? Why aren't you having more fun? You know, like, so it's the superego injunction of enjoy, enjoy, enjoy. Now, for me, in Christianity, the answer is, what's the answer to that? Well, the false answer is, of course, because this creates anxiety, right? The more you have to enjoy, the more social fragmentation, the more jealous you are of the people around you, the more anxious you are because it's not working for you. And so you're always tempted to go back to conservative values. So a lot of progressives end up going back to conservative churches. things like to have sex, right? It's very hard for progressives to have sex, right? In LA, there's you want to go to Hillsong. You want to kind of like have these structures of prohibition. So in America, they invented a technology to help young people have sex, like this thing called a purity ring, where you wore it, and by wearing it, you said, I won't have sex, which then made sex sexy again. And, you know, so people with purity rings statistically have more sex than people who don't. So you have to have these prohibitions in order to kind of create desire and all blah, 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 blah. Anyway, but the answer for me, and this is the Christian answer, is it's not that some of us are castrated, but God isn't, right? The early, you know, we're all castrated except for God. It's not that nobody's castrated. That's only a contingent thing. You can be non-castrated. The answer is we're all castrated, including God, right? Including the absolute. And what that means is you realize in yourself that no matter how good your life is, to be human is to be riven with desire and with unknowing. And that's part of the very wound of being. And that is in all possible worlds, to use a little bit of analytic philosophy, is that you have to not only think that your present life is riven, you have to realize that all possible worlds are riven with contradiction. And then in that, you identify with Christ, who was experienced God as contradiction. And in that, you're free not to be happy. You're freed from happiness. Mm-hmm. The church gives you the space where you're freed not to pursue what will make you whole and complete, but where you're finally freed from the pursuit of what will make you whole and complete. Do I hear an amen?
No, you do not. You hear a what the hell, maybe. Isn't that just a really selective reading of Christ's life to say that he experienced God as a negation? I mean, it's true. He said that from the cross. There's something deeply important about that in Christian theology, but it's against a backdrop of a unity, a primary unity with God that we are all striving for within Christianity. To get back to Randy's question, I mean, this is heading to wholeness and unity, or it isn't historic Christianity. And
here's a way of reading. Like, I'm interested in, if you take, which I think the historical Jesus stuff brings you here, right? And this is not like, I'm not as interested in that. I'm very Christological, so I'm very interested in Christology. But if you were taking a historical Jesus look in this, and if you were to say, controversial as it is, if you were to say that the central kind of message of Jesus is to love your enemy and love your neighbor, right? And if then you take love as in the psychoanalytic notion that to love someone is to embrace not what is the same about them, right? Well, that's lust, you know, I like people who are the same as me, but to love is to embrace the dimension of otherness within the other, right? So to love is to open yourself up to the torrent that is the other in their otherness. Then I think you can connect Christology, and my Christology is that we embrace a fundamental unknowing in reality with Jesus, who is saying that we have to embrace the unknown and unknowing das Ding of the other. So I do think you can link those two together.
Yeah. I don't like that either. I don't know if I have time to explain why, though. Seems like Randy's itching to say something.
No. I mean, I'm hearing a lot of, when I try to interpret and make sense of what you're saying, Pete, I think of the incarnation and the, we could say, paradox or contradiction of the divine becoming human and God embracing limitations and God embracing lack of experience in the divine, perhaps. And maybe that's forever melded into the experience of God now. That's where I'm trying to integrate it. Is this helping me make sense of incarnational Christianity?
In terms of what, and this is where maybe we're together. One of the things we may be together, may not, although it's funny because you guys are more prone to epistemological humility and epistemological unknowing, which, by the way, is the difference between Kant and Hegel. Kant is epistemological.
So I was just about
Hegel
to ask you about Kant, unknowing. So I'm glad you brought that up. How is this not just, maybe you think Kant was wrong, I don't know, but the whole, it seems to me the claim that you're making is a metaphysical claim. Which is, maybe you're totally comfortable with that. I'm not as familiar with Hegel as I am with Kant. My understanding is that Hegel got Kant wrong in some significant ways, which is a view I inherit from my teachers, so that may be wrong. But the argument Kant makes about the inaccessibility of the noumenal world seems to leave us in a position of like the best we can strive for is a kind of intellectual humility. When it comes to concepts like, is there a fundamental contradiction or a fundamental, I don't know, positivity of being in the universe? Like his whole antinomy thing, I think, is like really useful to this, because you can totally construct seemingly sound arguments in both directions for any kind of claim like that.
Yeah.
And that seems compelling to me, always has. And so, how do you get around
and that? Okay, brilliant. I'm glad you brought, because I was going to bring the antinomies up, because, and this is really where analytic and continental philosophy part, right? They part at Kant, right? So analytic and continental philosophy basically read everybody the same up to Kant. And then after Kant, right, the continentals take Hegel seriously. And most analytics don't. There's a couple of analytic philosophers who read Hegel. But, you know, but in general, analytic philosophy was born out of a rejection of Hegel. Think of people like, obviously, Russell, Frege, all of that. So, and even, you know, logical positivism, et cetera, et cetera. But so here's the claim. Here's the difference between Kant and Hegel in a nutshell, is because Hegel is a Kantian in a sense, but he turns Kant up to 11, right? The whole point is he critiques Kant by, from a Hegelian position, taking Kant even more seriously than Kant, right? So Kant shows that reason, pure reason, brings you to antinomies. And the antinomies are things like God exists, God doesn't exist, the world is infinitely divisible, the universe is not infinitely divisible.
Has a beginning.
A couple more, right? So the world has a beginning, the universe doesn't have a beginning, right? These antinomies. Now, what Hegel, and I have to show why Hegel does, but what Hegel does is Hegel goes, yes, and this is exactly what I'm doing with Gödel, is Hegel says, yeah, the problem here is Kant thinks that because pure reason brings you to antinomies, it hasn't had an insight into ultimate reality. And Hegel says, the antinomies is an insight into fundamental reality.
Okay, yeah. Right?
Pause for a second. What's antinomy?
Contradiction.
Sort of. It's not. Yeah, it's just the recognition that there are basic facts about the world. Not facts. There are basic disagreements, I suppose, about fundamental reality that all of human reason and evidence can't answer for you, because you can use it to construct opposed conclusions about those things. So for Kant, this implies, or actually, it was just kind of an outworking of his prior system, but like, it implies that the thing, the world as it exists really in itself, is unapproachable to us. It's like not something we have any kind of rational access to. All we have access to is the appearances, how things seem to us. And okay. So everything we can describe down to fundamental physics is about appearances of things.
Yeah. And then what Hegel does is he ontologizes that, where he says, you know, this unknowing. So like one example, Zizek uses this, but he borrows it from somebody else, is you imagine a computer game that you're playing, and you go into a room that the computer programmer never expected you to go into. And so you kind of go into this weird fuzzy thing, right? The idea is, is it Mitch Hedberg?
Hedberg, whatever the comedian?
Yeah, the comedian, yeah. He has a great joke where he says, he's like in a stone kind of way. He says, have you ever noticed that all the photos of Bigfoot are blurry? They go like, yeah, they're always blurry. And then he says, listen, this really freaks me out. He says, what if Bigfoot is blurry? Right? But that's basically what Hegel does with Kant. Kant says, you know, we get, whenever we push pure reason to its ultimate form, we get blurriness or antinomies, right?
Looks like
and then
a duck.
Hegel says,
looks like a duck.
Reality is blurry.
Yeah, that's fun. I did not expect Mitch Hedberg to come up in this conversation.
Good.
That's wonderful.
That's fantastic.
Have you ever read Charles Peirce?
Oh, a long time ago, and only a small amount, a little bit. I've never really read the American.
Both of our homework will be, I will go read some Hegel, you will go read some Peirce. We will come back together.
Okay, perfect.
Peirce is my favorite philosopher, the father of American pragmatism. And he has this famous quote. Maybe you could consider this like there's like a Peircean axiom and like maybe a Hegelian axiom. I don't know if that's a fair way to put it, but like he says, there's a motto which deserves to be inscribed upon every wall of the city of philosophy. And that motto is, do not block the way of inquiry. And he thinks that has happened a lot. And to me, if we're not starting with that because we have a desire to learn, and that's why we're getting into philosophy, right? We have a desire to examine ourselves in the Socratic sense. And if we're constructing along the path barriers to continue in that process, then we're giving up on the project. And it seems to me that some of the stuff you're describing is that kind of barrier. But maybe it's just because I'm misunderstanding it.
No, you're absolutely right. No, I'm very unapologetically making a claim that we can have insight into ultimate reality, absolutely, unapologetically. And that's why I'm not a I started off as a post-structuralist. My PhD was in post-structuralism, mm-hmm. right? And but I'm very much a Hegelian Lacanian. But I will say this, I actually think that it's pretty unavoidable. So you basically, if you've got, you know, a variety of positions on negation, right? Either we don't know stuff, but we can know. Like the whole Hegelian thing was that Kant was actually pretending to be, he was pretending to be humble, but he actually wasn't humble because he said the in itself is inaccessible. That is a claim, you know. It's like
sure.
So Hegel goes like,
yeah, he did not take his project to be an exercise in humility. Like it entails some humility about metaphysics, but it's not itself an attempt at humility. He thought it was just the rational outworking of the cognitive structure of rational beings. So,
but the in itself is obviously the barrier, you know. But it is a positive claim. There's a limit.
Absolutely.
To we've got the transcendental categories, and we, you know, these are limits, et cetera, et cetera. But my point being is like, so you got Kant, you've got someone like, let's take Derrida. Derrida is the idea that there is a constant openness within language to eternal meaning. Mm-hmm. So whenever we talk about democracy, there is always a way to reinterpret democracy or hospitality or justice. So there's the nature of language is an openness to eschatological future, an unknown future, right? There's that. Then there's the Lacanian idea that the lack is the name for subjectivity, that the unconscious is. So the lack is not something that you can't know. It's not just some openness always to the future, but it is actually something in operation in your being. These are all positions. I just take the third.
Yeah, sure. And the thing that maybe annoys me the most about Hegelians is insisting that there is a third when there doesn't always need to be a third.
Yes.
It's kind of like the old joke about Freud, you know, sometimes it's just a damn cigar. Sometimes it really is just a binary.
That's true. No, you know what? It's true. And even Hegel said, like, Hegel was like, don't turn dialectics into a dogma. Like, if you don't find a dialectic, don't assume it's there.
Well,
and so you're absolutely right.
And it
is true that some people, I'm a dialectician, and I would have a tendency to always look for a dialectical dimension.
Yeah.
But to be true, it's just like in psychoanalysis, which I'm very influenced by psychoanalysis. You can know all the theory, but someone like Bion and Winnicott, they say this in Lacan as well. When you go into the room with the analysand, you have to allow anything to happen. Don't allow the theory to dictate what happens in the clinic. So you're absolutely right, is that when I hit reality, I have to be careful not to see everything as a dialectic nail because I have
so
a
So we're back to
hammer.
Intellectual humility as a foundational principle, right?
Yes, when I talk about ontological humility, it's not that I'm saying as opposed to epistemological humility.
Sure, sure,
like
sure.
I don't want to sound like, oh, I know everything about it. I don't know anything about anything. So it's not a dish. It's just whether there is a dimension to reality that is inherently non-deterministic.
Right.
And you could say, we don't know. We could say no, or we could say yes. Mm-hmm. And those are all legitimate positions.
Well, yeah, there's so much more to dig into here, man. I don't see non-determinism as the thing that you're aiming at. It may be involved, but it's indeterminism is different from, like, isn't saying there's negation or contradiction, that's a kind of determinism in the sense that it is a determinative property of the universe. It's not indeterminism, which is a
fundamentally different thing. No, because it's not, it's technically the nothing is not something. And this is, I mean, Lacan used it in terms of in the library system, the catalog, where you can go into a library and the books have no gap in them. But when you look at the cards, you can see maybe a book is missing, right? So it's in the symbolic. The real is in the symbolic. The real isn't in the in physical reality, although I would argue it is. So non-determinism, what I would argue is that's basically that's exactly what I'm arguing about, is that this idea of lack or nothing or indeterminism is saying that there is a reality is not fully computable. Now, if an infinite mind can know everything, can know where all things will be, where all things are going, and know everything, if an infinite mind can know all, then the universe is, in theory or in practice, it is deterministic. If an infinite mind still doesn't know with exact accuracy the position and the speed of a subatomic particle, then there is a dimension of reality that is non-computable. That's what I'm arguing for.
Let's let that sit there.
Okay. All right. I'll hold it in.
Yeah. I'm going to ask a really boring question. I'm sorry to dumb this down, Peter, but you grew up in Belfast during the Troubles, and you even hinted at what happened in 1998, a new vision of the future possibly, you know, being created together. But I'm interested in two questions. One, what was it like to grow up in Belfast during the Troubles? And we in the States live in a very fractured, bitter, partisan world where it almost feels not nearly close to Catholic and Protestant in Northern Ireland, but it feels like this bitterness and divide and division and partisanship is just growing and growing and growing, and something's going to break, like January 6th kind of. And I'm interested to know, do you see any parallels between the Troubles in the Northern Ireland reality and what we find in the States right now?
Yeah, I mean, some people have said that Northern Ireland is where identity politics became weaponized, that we actually, because, you know, between Catholic and Protestant and all of this, that actually this, the Troubles, the 30-year war, was a conflict about identity, or it was dressed up in that way. And that ultimately we almost destroyed the place. The whole country was almost destroyed. We got to a certain point where we had to sit down and try to work things out and realize, and this is where my personal journey and my philosophical journey kind of intertwine, in that we realized that we were unified not in terms of identity, but in terms of shared trauma, which is shared lack, and that we could find some way to come together with that and try to work things out without knowing what the future looked like. So I love America. I lived in America for 12 years, 15 years. I'm probably going to move back at some point. Because I love Ireland and I love America. I love the West Coast. But yes, I saw a lot of conflict that reminded me of my youth. Definitely. When I was living in LA, there are certain things I saw on the streets that completely brought me back to Belfast. And so I would like to do more work on trying to bring some of the ideas from the peace process in Northern Ireland to a wider, into wider political conversations. That's part of the work that I want to do in the next 10 years. Mostly what I want to do, but is create these liturgies of lack. But that is connected to trying to help people who are very different in terms of their identities. So AA is a good example. In AA, there's people who are rich and poor, conservatives and Republicans and Democrats and all of that, but they come together through a shared particular trauma, the trauma of their alcohol. And weirdly, they unify around this space of pure grace where they accept each other without judgment. They hear each other say, "I'm an alcoholic," and they all nod saying, "We're alcoholics as well." And there is a social bond that is formed through a shared negation, a shared trauma. The social bond is fragmented in contemporary society for a number of reasons that I mentioned. There's a great book by Todd McGowan called The End of Dissatisfaction, which I think is very, very good, but it explores the fragmentation of the social bond, and it was written 20 years ago. I want to see how we can have a social bond based on as I say, not some identity, because you know what, that is fragmenting in a huge way, but somehow create a social bond around shared a shared loss. So anyway, that's just some waffling.
Yeah,
no, I don't want us to get into theory again, because then we'll start arguing and we'll never get off.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Can I ask two more questions? Just one serious and one less serious. Following on that, I was going
to
ask...
I think I've ruined your podcast. I don't think anyone's going to listen to you.
You're just going to be like, you got to continue that conversation.
Yeah. So following on what you just said, I was going to ask you anyway about ethical boundaries, because it came up in our last conversation. And so in the sense of when you're doing this thing to the people, for the people that you do this for,
I think you're getting at the
question.
You
have a kind of guru-dom, right?
The statement of when I disillusion you enough,
you're never
disillusioned again. Or you're never be illusioned again.
Yes. What are, and it's connected to what you're just describing, as this vision of having a community built around a shared loss. But what are like the ethical limitations on sharing that vision with people? Let me give you just an example. And this isn't an accusation at all. I recognize it's in the thought that you're drawing from, but you've used castration a lot as a metaphor, which is obviously sexist, right? It has some sexist implications, and like, you know, Freud and women is a whole fraught thing. And you're using that as a metaphor for like a deep truth about reality, and it has obvious gender implications. And so when we're carrying ideas like this into a very practical context where we're trying to help people think about their Christian practice and their whole orientation to the world, how do you set limits on doing good for people or protecting from harm?
So first of all, I am very wary of using those big words, sexism, racism. I'm very wary of that. I know in America, those words are commonly used. So I want to say just publicly and whatever, like those words are words I use very sparingly and carefully. The psychoanalytic discourse has castration is a term that is a technical term used by in a discipline that is predominantly, I think there's more women in that tradition than men. So you know, like Alenka Sapanchik's What is Sex, for example, you know, but you get Julia Kristeva, you could talk about Lucy Gray or whatever. So I want to be careful. I'd want to pull back from. I know castration is not a technical term within a psychoanalytic theoretical discourse. Just be wary of kind of like just saying, oh, it's sexist, because you know, or whatever. But so that's one thing. Then what was the other bit?
Yeah, that was really just an example of. It seems like we're bringing these ideas into a practical context, and these ideas have. Some potentially harmful implications depending on how they're applied. And so how do you set for your own endeavors? How do you guide yourself towards the good of the people you're trying to give this to?
Yes. Well, this is my ethical position. Like I fundamentally think that people who promise wholeness, completeness, fulfillment, whether it's capitalism, whether it's Christianity, whether it's the New Age, whether it's psychedelic enlightenment or sexual liberation, I think that that's profoundly damaging, profoundly dangerous. I think it leads to depression, melancholy, lots of the modern symptoms of the age. I fundamentally believe that creating a space where we can be freed from the pursuits of wholeness and fulfillment, and we can embrace our unknowing, our lack, where we can encounter each other in our unknowing and in that dimension of struggle, that is fundamentally healthy, that it helps people profoundly. I'm committed to psychoanalysis. I actually do psychoanalysis, actually, as in I'm in psychoanalysis, and I take psychoanalytic ideas and I apply them because for ethical reasons. This is, again, I am against most mental health ideas. I'm against the idea that we should try to make people more productive, seize the day, kind of accomplish more, be all they can be, all of that. I'm very much want to help people develop a curiosity with their own unconscious, to come to know their own defense mechanisms and come to a place where I think they can live better. So we're all trying to be ethical, like we're all trying to do the good, but that's what I think the good is. Right. And mm-hmm. if I think the good is something else, then I'll move into something else. But yes, I do this work because I genuinely believe that we live in a society where we look at other people who seem to have the thing. We're constantly mm-hmm. told that we should be more, do more, seize the day, optimize. We're constantly even told that if we're going to do something recreational, we do it so as we can be more productive, et cetera, et cetera. And I just believe that that is damaging and dangerous.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's helpful. Thank you.
Yeah.
Last question, maybe the most important one I've asked. What do you think about the movie The Big Lebowski?
Oh, I saw that. I love The Big Lebowski. I remember it, but it's been so long since I've seen it that I would like you to kind of tell me what your association is with this conversation. Because I think you're onto something, but I'd like to hear what you think.
What made me think of it was your comment in our last conversation was that I think you're talking about your experience in LA, but you said something like you can't even do drugs anymore without having it mean something. And to me, the dude, you know, the Big Lebowski, is like the antithesis of that, to use a Hegelian term. he's just existing. And he does drugs and it doesn't mean anything. And there's a kind of
Dude abides.
He abides, right? And there's a heroism in an implied heroism in that. And it seems like very much up your alley, the whole ethos of that film.
That connection I love. So yeah, I think there's something really good there. Thank you.
Fun. Well, Peter Rollins, thank you for just opening up and trying to and engaging this conversation with us. It's been fascinating, really fun, really challenging. And we'd love to have you on again to just process some more about this stuff.
Brilliant. Listen, I really appreciate being a guest on the show. And I love this back and forth. Let's have more of it. So thank
you. Awesome.
Thank you, Pete. Thanks for listening to A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk Into a Bar. We hope you're enjoying these conversations. Help us continue to create compelling content and reach a wider audience by supporting us at patreon.com/apastorandaphilosopher, where you can get bonus content, extra perks, and a general feeling of being a good person.
Also, please rate and review the show in Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. These help new people discover the show, and we may even read your review in a future episode.
If anything we said pissed you off, or if you just have a question you'd like us to answer, send us an email at pastorandphilosopher@gmail.com.
Find us on social media at PPWBpodcast, and find transcripts and links to all of our episodes at pastorandphilosopher.buzzsprout.com.
See you next time.
Cheers.